All right. Hey, guys. This is Nikhil.
And this is Nick.
And welcome back to Informatonauts.
This is the big decade episode. Our podcast is now officially double-digit weeks old.
I know. Awesome. Awesome. I'm so happy that we made it this far.
Me too. It's a little bit surprising, honestly. I don't generally tend to follow through on things as well as I should, but...
Persistence,
right. But I guess when you have two people together, it works out better.
Yep. I will come down on you if you don't do the podcast, and you'll come down on me, so...
That's absolutely true. Although we may not do it next week since we're all out of town.
Next week is vacation week.
Next week is vacation.
I'm going to be off the grid. I'm sorry.
That's true. Of course, off the grid in San Francisco. I don't think that means the same thing as it does in, like, Idaho, but, you know, close enough, right?
Well, off the grid in my parents' house. I'm going to be cooped up playing video games with my mom feeding me, and I'm not going to be doing anything.
Dude, I'm so jealous. I have house guests this next week. Uh-huh. And my apartment, I don't know if it's necessarily big enough for the number of house guests, but we're going to give it a shot, so we'll see.
Cool.
Yeah. You finally going to fix that bathroom, or do they finally hire a professional?
No, they've released me of my promise. So, guys, before I came to grad school, I was doing some remodeling for my parents. And
because you're just manly like that.
Yeah. I like doing it. My dad does, too. We just don't like to hire contractors a lot of the time. Like, almost every major job we've done on our home has been just my father and I. And it's taken forever, and it doesn't look the prettiest, but we're proud of it. And before I left, I promised them that I would remodel the bathroom, and I just never got around to it. And I went back over winter break, didn't do it. Over spring break, didn't do it. It's been 2 years now, and they're finally just like, Nikhil, it's all right. Just let it go. We'll do it a different time. So, yeah, they've released me from that promise.
Yeah, that's probably good. I tend to, my parents, I'm not nearly as handy with any sort of tools or anything of that nature, so my parents don't hold me to those types of things, but there's lots of other things that need to...
But you're the tech guy in your family.
I am the tech guy, so I usually end up doing stuff like that, of fixing my brother's computer, and, you know, an interesting story, I went home last summer, and my parents said, hey, will you look at my younger brother's computer? My younger brother is, he's a freshman in high school, and so he has his iPad from the school that they give him, and then he also has my dad's old Windows work PC or work laptop, and he was using it, and I went to go clean it up, and it was just like loaded with spyware and viruses, and it was like right at the early, like, that time in the early 2000s where you would open up your like grandparents' computer and it would just have the toolbars stacked like 10 deep.
Yep.
That's exactly what had happened. And I was talking to him, I said, Jonathan, what did you... Like, he had no idea what was happening or how that had gotten there. And what had dawned on me was that he's part of the internet era in which the internet is accessed from the iPad and iPhones and things like that. So he has no idea about viruses or spyware. He has no idea to click to install things. He doesn't know how to read. Nobody ever taught him or trained him how to do that. And I was thinking, like, when I was learning about the internet, like us and all of our buddies, right? We talked about this stuff, like, oh, what firewall are you running? You run Zone Alarm? Oh, better be running Zone Alarm, right? And it was like trading, you know, cracked versions of McAfee back and forth, like,
yeah, I mean, totally.
That was part of the internet, was you learned how to avoid the porn sites and the spyware sites, right? And nobody has ever taught him how to do, like, stuff like that, because it's not an issue for his friends because they all have iPads and iPod Touches.
That's crazy. Yeah. I didn't even, like, think about that. I know my cousin, who's just a baby right now, she loves the iPad. She plays with it all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And she can use it, but I'm thinking now when she's older, she's going to, you know, be almost technology illiterate. She might be able to, like, use technology, but she might not. She's not going to know how to, you know... fire up a word processor maybe, yeah. on a Mac. Who knows?
Yeah.
It's crazy. I didn't even consider that.
Yeah. I had never either. And I had to, like, stop and, like, remember to help, like, explain to my brother what was going on and how to avoid it and avoid these problems. And, you know, it really, if we talk about the internet becoming a utility, and I think we finally hit that point where people are really genuinely starting to think along those lines. To my brother, the internet just is, and it just is there, right? It's just immediately available. It's just something that you just turn it on, access it, and shut it off, and you don't think about the additional consequences, right? So the analog that I can think of is like growing up when parents say, turn off the water, right? Don't waste water. What am I wasting water for? It's like, is there, I mean, granted, I'm not from the West Coast where you have like water shortages and stuff. It's like, I know I'd never thought about that before, mm-hmm. but... or electricity, right? Oh, turn the light off. Okay. I mean, could you imagine? I can imagine time. I assume that there was a time when you had to, like, be careful what you plugged into outlets and, like, because you didn't have a large enough service going to your apartment or something like that.
And oh, you still do.
I mean, you kind like you kind of do. Like, you can plug to, like, you don't plug anything in a hairdryer into a house. And I have some friends here, some med students. They had me come over because they're one of their outlets melted, and like you looked at it, and they had like so much stuff plugged into one circuit. It's like, okay.
Have they heard of a surge protector? These exist.
Yeah, I don't know what it. This is a wonky, weird house that it was. I don't necessarily know if it's up to code, but
you know, it could be that. You know, my girlfriend, where she lives, she actually does not have grounds in her outlet.
It's an old enough house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And I was in total awe. I had no idea those still existed. Like, is that even up to code? Is that even legal?
I believe that they're basically grandfathered in, but anytime you make a change, you have to put. Now, part of it is that the wires, they're only two prong. There's not a third. A lot of them don't have a third ground line.
Yeah, but it could cause a fire.
Yeah, but that's the way. What's the alternative? You would have to retrofit all the wiring in that house. So you basically had to like gut the house and rewire it.
Wasn't that safer than having a two-prong outlet?
It may be safer, but is it economically feasible? Think how many houses were built. Let's see. So grounded wires, I think, came in basically at the end of World War II, early 1950s kind of thing.
Well, and since when has the government been economically feasible?
Well, right now it's just kind of, what are you going to do when you displace all these people while their houses are being renovated? So, but no, I absolutely agree. But it's just funny where, you know, where as each technology comes in, like, were you growing up, do you have, quote unquote, the Farmer Five for your, like, television and stuff like that?
The Farmer Five.
The rabbit ear antennas to, the rabbit ear antennas to plug into your TV, and you got, like, the basic five channels. You got, like, ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, like, and you had to, like, tune it to, like, line it up correct?
Yeah, that was stupid.
Yeah, I mean, my younger brother doesn't know any. He just, I mean, my parents got satellite right after they left, right after I left for college, of course. And and they just, like, he just turns it on, and it's just a service. It's just something that is always there to him. And I think maybe he has an idea that somebody pays for it, right? You have to buy this stuff. But you just buy a package, and it comes, and it's, like, all set up for you.
Right.
And
I got my first email when I was maybe 5 or 6 years old.
Like, really?
My AOL address. And I remember actually getting the internet. Like, that was a thing for us. That was like, oh, wow. You know, I have my computer with games on it, but now we're going to actually have America Online. And that was like a big thing. And I'm thinking now that, like you said, like your brother, my cousin and stuff, they're just going to take it for granted and be like, well, we've always had the internet. It's just been there. It's just existed. It's just like this thing for them.
Yeah, and it's moving so much towards this, you know, this app utility mindset where it's like, things are vetted for me, right? So my apps don't have viruses in it, unless I'm on Google's platform, then they might. But, like, you just don't even have to think and worry about it. It's not installing random stuff in the background. I don't know.
That's insane.
It definitely is. I'm trying to remember when I got my first email. I was probably maybe 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. And my dad got, the company bought him, like, oh my gosh, maybe 50 hours of internet a month. Like, he never ever used it. Isn't that the thing? Like, everybody, it seems like you hear these common stories that, like, their parents got it through work. They got a laptop or a computer or something, then never used it.
Mm-hmm.
And then
the kids did.
But the kids did, right? So we got, like, 50 hours a month of online access, and the computer was in my brother's room down the hall, so you had to run. You had to unplug the phone and run. Because, you know, we couldn't go out and buy a $2 splitter.
Right? Yeah, of course.
So you had to unplug the phone and run the cable. We had like a 50-foot, you know, RJ11 cable that we had to run down the hallway and plug in. And when I built my computer, I had an external 56K US robotics modem.
And how old were you when you built this computer?
That was 7th or 8th grade.
That's awesome. That was my sixth grade, sorry.
Yeah.
So when I was in the 5th grade, I got my first computer. It was like a 400 megahertz.
Yes.
At the time, a beast.
Yeah.
And I was totally in love with it, and I was just like, it's all I do all day.
Oh, hands down.
But I never got to build my own computer until I was actually out of college. Like, that's when I was just like, you know what? I need to live this dream.
Yeah.
And I went out, and I designed my own gaming PC, and I built it. And it's actually in my parents' house now. My dad's totally abusing it. He's kind of just using it for movies, and he's not playing any games, so it's just going to waste. And he's, like, gotten attached to it, so he's not letting go of it either.
Yeah.
So I kind of have to get a new one. Speaking of which, I really want Titanfall so bad.
Titanfall.
So bad. Yeah. Have you seen this game?
I have. Just real briefly. I didn't really... I haven't dug into it too much. So that's the... It's basically like you get in the giant robot.
And yes.
It's basically like Pacific Rim, right?
I
guess... Did you ever see Pacific Rim?
I did not see Pacific Rim.
Oh, that's a good movie.
But it's like a reskin Call of Duty. And I love first-person shooter games. I'm mm-hmm. just like... That's like my genre of games. And... it's basically Call of Duty with robots, and you fly into a big robot, and then you walk around the map just shooting things up and destroying things and making havoc. And it seems like the most fun thing ever. And I did not buy a next-generation console. My Xbox 360 got the Red Ring of Death.
Oh, yeah.
So that's done for. My gaming PC is with my parents now, so I am gameless. And I was looking for a way to, I was trying to figure out if I should actually buy an Xbox One or if I should buy a PS4
mm-hmm.
or if I should build my own gaming computer again.
Because Titanfall runs on PCs, right?
It does. It does. And I've heard that the Xbox One and PS4 are, like, they're kind of lackluster in terms of specs compared
mm-hmm.
to a PC that you can build.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for the life of me, I tried to build a comparable PC and something that I can actually, like, add to and build on and keep long-term. And I just could not do it for less than $750. And I was looking at the actual components, like, part for part, it looks like the Xbox One should cost more than what they're charging. I think they might be taking a hit selling it at $500 a pop.
Probably. I know that traditionally hardware vendors have, especially in the earlier runs. Now, of course, remember, they get economies of scale, right? So it's not that they're not paying necessarily list prices. They're getting, in some cases, a pretty steep discount.
Well, sure. And on top of that, they also charge you money for their, like, Xbox Live service. And
yeah. So. But it is very much a services and games and accessories business. So it has been that way since, really, I mean, the first Xbox never, ever made money.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the case. And then it was, and they were pioneering this new type of model. And then the Xbox One is where they made up all the money through services and things like that. But it wasn't, usually it's not until I think the second or third iteration.
Do you mean Xbox and Xbox 360?
Yeah, Xbox 360. Yes, the Xbox 360 was where they made all the money.
Right, that makes sense.
And then the Xbox One now is interesting. And I think it's usually the second or third iteration of the, so the PS3 is one that's undergone like several like revisions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the second or third one, I think it's probably the third one where they started making money on the boxes themselves. And so I think then they were able to, they're dropping the prices, but, so they get economies of scale and all that kind of stuff, but yeah, absolutely. Especially in the early days, you take a hit on the hardware in order to get that market share and to get people going so you can incentivize developers to come to your platform.
You know, I've been thinking about this recently, but over the past 2 years or so that I've known you, we haven't talked games at all. Do you play video games?
I am not a gamer. And I'm a little bit funky in the fact that I've tried many times to become a gamer,
uh-huh.
and it just doesn't.
It doesn't take.
It doesn't take. I have a PS3. I bought it. I bought it a year after it came out, I think,
mm-hmm.
like Black Friday, and I bought it primarily as a Blu-ray player and as a like a media center, and also because I was just fascinated. I've always been fascinated by the PowerPC architecture.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's just really cool. And so the PS3, of course, was the quote-unquote cell, but it was IBM chip. And I love Age of Empires. I used to play Age of Empires all the time with my with my cousins when we go to visit for New York, right? That's the land parties. Age of Empires 2.
That's insane how every family has done that.
Everybody, like, right?
Exactly.
We used to get up, you know, we used to all group up into my uncle's house and, like, on all these old, you know.
With those big CRT monitors that take up the entire desk.
And you're just, like, sitting there sweating. And my dad at the time had one of those, like, Gateway convertible, like Windows XP tablet edition, like, convertibles. That thing is so much fun to play Age on. Because you can kind of, like, flip it over so you've got your hotkeys, right? And then you're using the pen to tap and draw and move. It's not, obviously, you're not going to win any speed rounds, but that's a really fun way to play. It's like touch enabled.
Have you played Sid Meier's Civilization?
That is my game.
Really?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
I've actually never played that game before.
I love.
I'm going to buy it.
Yeah. It's, Civ. My favorite is Civ 4. Civ 4 is just so unbelievably, like, complex and intricate. Like, they add in, like, issues where now, like, they have religion and govern, like political systems and things that affect your relationship with your neighbor. So if your religion espouses, like, Taoism, and or Confucianism, I think, is the one, and then, like, the neighboring empire is Jewish, like, that affects the way that they'll interact and, like, work with you. And then, you can send, like, missionaries over and convert, like, other cities. And then,
but you have Age of Empires, those little monks that would kind of stand behind the trees and just convert people.
Yeah, yeah. But it was, but you have that, you have economic systems, and all this stuff plays together. And then Civ 5 is, like, gorgeous and all this stuff, but they simplified it a little bit, which makes the game move faster and is less complicated. But there's something awesome about Civ 4 that's just, like, you really have to think and work hard on it. And the games last forever and all that stuff. So I love the turn-based strategy, that kind of stuff. So,
you know, I've heard a rumor, and I don't know if this is true or not. It's just a rumor that Civilization, like, that entire franchise was written by a one-man army.
Sid Meier's?
Yeah. And not just him, but, like, the Doom franchise, same deal. A one-man army, which amazes me because, frankly, anybody who's written software knows how much time and effort goes into making it and making it right. Like people say, there's three things you don't ever want to, like, see being made, and that's sausage, laws, and software.
Yeah.
So that just blows me away that a one-man guy, like a one-man team, built Civilization.
Let's see. It says... Oh, it doesn't say... I don't think... No, he necessarily wrote it, but he was the driving force behind it, and which is kind of mind-blowing, so... So that's really my game. And then I also play, I have played, like, Command & Conquer. Command & Conquer is a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And a few other of those kinds of games. But I would love to be, and I've played, I haven't quite beaten it yet, but I have played and really enjoyed Assassin's Creed. So I want to get back and finish that up finally. And it just kind of, the game just kind of drags towards the end. But I've heard you kind of have to get through it and go on. And my roommate and I in college used to play Borderlands every now and then and stuff.
Borderlands, that's one franchise I haven't gotten into
yet. Yeah, that one's fun. The best part is they have a catch-up feature, so he's just so much better. I mean, I'm terrible. When I say I, like, get really into games, like, maybe I'll, like, binge and play, like, a lot over a couple days or a week and then forget about it and drop off.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like So I don't play games all that often. And But we'd always be about, like, two, because, you know, it's a level up feature in your level up game. We'd always be one or two levels behind, or I would always be one or two levels behind. So, but that was close enough in the grand scheme of things that we were basically, like, we could, like, share weapons and do all this stuff. And so I never got too far behind, which was nice. And that's a fun co-op game. But I've always wanted to really get into games as for their art and their creativity and, like, the storyline. But I just can't do it.
I've always wanted to write my own game, which I've never gotten around to doing.
Of course.
And it seems like it's really hard.
I think so.
Have you been attempted?
Yeah. Have you ever used Game Maker?
I've tried Game Maker before, actually, at one point.
Didn't everybody use Game Maker?
For RPGs, right? It's a good RPG GUI tool.
I think so, yeah. I think it was Game Maker. It's like this little game, right? You'd, like, define your little sprites and, like, okay, hit left, hit right, do the collision.
It's on Steam. What do you know?
It is.
But yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And I've actually... Oh, the last thing I tried to use was something called Unity.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard of Unity. That was just demoed in... AMD, that's what they use.
Yeah, it's a really cool engine. And I think you can plug in the Unreal 4 engine, which just came out, and a lot of crazy games, including Assassin's Creed, was written with the Unreal engine.
Yeah.
So it's very, very powerful. But I think, again, you know, a one-man team is not going to be able to make something phenomenal. But maybe a Flappy Bird, who knows?
I don't know, dude. There's, like, lots of interesting stuff that's being done with, like, all these, like, indie games and stuff. I think part of it is you're right to do something that, like, rivals, like, Battlefield or something in, like, visual quality and images. Like, that's just, there's so much that goes into those games.
Oh, and marketing. Oh, my God.
Of course. But even just the game itself, right? There's so much that goes into that the sheer number of hours required, it's not just an issue of being brilliant and efficient. There's just too much that goes into it. But there are a lot of really interesting and beautiful games that are being created by, where you sort of embrace the limitations. So say, we can't just win. We can't win just on sheer graphical prowess.
Mm-hmm.
So either we figure out a way to cleverly generate these graphics with the computer. Like some of those like little Starfire games, like all the backgrounds are just like they throw out a bunch of equations and it's generated randomly in real time kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So then they get their art direction done by math or something like that. But then you focus on like gameplay and character development and story, and you can do art direction of creating simple graphics or something that looks really beautiful. So there's ways to get around it, but you're right, you can't just go toe to toe and create, you know, Battleship, you know, or something or whatever. I mean what's ever different than Battlefield, like Battle Mountain, and compete with some of these studios. There's just too much that goes into it.
But if you think about it, you know, a lot of these games, you know, the reason I play a lot of these games is because I like the storyline.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to playing a first-person shooter, I want it to be like an action movie. Instead of watching an action movie, I want to play it. I want to live it. And that is where a lot of these major studios excel, is that they're able to get these great storylines.
Yeah.
And the indie studios are just not able to keep up sometimes. But I think maybe in the long run, if game writers, like the people who write the stories for these games, are able to kind of branch out and do more indie jobs, like I think that would give a lot of indie studios a fighting chance to compete with these bigger guys.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought.
Because if the graphics are going to be doable, you know, with all this new software coming out with Unity and a bunch of other cool software out there, I don't know all of them.
Yeah.
And if the big issue is storyline and marketing, I think marketing power is still going to be an issue. But you know, if there's enough of a pull from people, and if a game, you know, wows enough people, I think it actually has a good chance of making it out there.
Yeah. Well, and there's lots of other, there's platforms. I mean, Steam has done a lot to diversify. The Humble Indie Bundle has done a lot to bring some of this stuff kind of to the forefront. And even iOS and Android, where you have these little games, you try out random things and stuff, is, there's not a lot, I think, to democratize game distribution. But you're right, there's it's always been this idea of this economies of scale, or just the, you know, the elephant in the room, which also defines what people expect of games and kind of stuff. So it's a challenge to be creative, but I think that there are some that are really meeting that. And there's been some really interesting stuff that I've just kind of answered. Again, I'm not really in that community, but I've been seeing it kind of poking around, you know, going forward. Now, Titanfall doesn't have really a story mode or storyline, does it?
I think it, you know, I'm not entirely sure. I know it's been, a lot of the cool stuff has to do with the actual multiplayer capability. Like, you get online and then you play with people. That's the fun stuff.
Of course.
There might be a campaign mode. I don't know if there really is. But we'll have to see. You know, I'll let you know when I get the game, which is hopefully going to be sometime in April.
Okay. So you're just going to go out and get your Xbox One?
I think so. I'm just going to bite the bullet and do it. Worst case scenario, I'm not going to like it. I'll go to eBay, sell it, and recoup most of the cash I spent on it.
Yeah.
Or I'll just return it if I don't like it soon enough. But for the most part, I think it's going to be fun.
Now, a lot of people, have you like followed any of the like the technical discussion of the Xbox versus the X-Bone versus the PS4, like from a technical perspective?
Not at all.
So supposedly, Microsoft made a bunch of interesting choices on how it handled its, how it did its technical architecture of providing additional audio processing and different like RAM levels and things like that. And but basically, the big thing is like so Battlefield runs at like 960p versus 1080p or something on the PS4, and which all the fanboys are like, oh, it's technically worse resolution. And then everybody pulls up the you know, not the basically, it's not the Nyquist chart, but like the visual chart that shows like what the human eye is actually capable of determining.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, unless you have a screen bigger than 72 inches and sit a foot and a half away from it, you can't tell that, you know, your eye physically can't determine the pixels and all that stuff. But, but one of the things I think Microsoft did right was that they realized that these game consoles, maybe not for the core, like the core gamer market, but they hit on what I call, or what's known as, and maybe this isn't the right term, but the wife acceptance factor. When you're trying to justify buying a new console to the wife or the family acceptance factor,
mm-hmm.
they're not going to be super wowed or like, you already have a great game console. Why do you need another one? Is this game not coming out on the PlayStation, the Xbox 360? Like, because Titanfall is like a month or two later.
Yep.
Like, do you not have that? And now, like, with Microsoft, with the Xbox, you can make an argument of saying, well, here's all the other things that it does. Like, here's what it does. It does the Netflix, and it does the audio commands, and all these little things that, like, help to instantiate it as a piece of your entertainment and, like, digital lifestyle, as opposed to just a core gaming box.
And Kinect. It comes with Kinect.
It comes with Kinect, which is really interesting. And obviously there aren't a lot of games right now that make a big push for that, but there's more than there are with, I have the PlayStation, what is it, the PS Move or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
It's like the little remotes that have the balls on the top, like the little glowing balls. It's actually kind of fun, but there's no games that really support it.
Hmm.
And part of that is because like nobody really bought it because it's kind of a silly little add-on. So now Microsoft's saying, fine, well, we're going to ship one for everybody. Everybody gets a Kinect. What can you do with that?
Well, I think a lot of the draw with the Kinect. So from a competitive standpoint, the Wii definitely is a competitor there. You know, like they have a lot of mobile, mm-hmm. like physical games. And I think Xbox is trying to sort of capitalize on that market. And with the Kinect, I know with my cousin, whenever my, you know, all the cousins get together and we hang out back in the Bay Area, we play Fruit Ninja.
Oh, yeah.
On the Xbox 360.
Yeah, your Blade Grinder plays Fruit Ninja with your beans every day, right?
Yeah. Oh, my God. That, speaking of, that grinder actually worked out pretty great. I mean, I don't know if it's as good as an electric burr grinder, but definitely it's getting the job done.
Okay.
So I'll bring it over one of these days and we can, I'll prove it to you.
Okay. All right, sounds good.
Speaking of games, before I forget, I know in the last show I mentioned that 2048 probably cannot be beaten. And I was sort of going through a bunch of theoretics as to why that could be. And it looks like I was just completely proved wrong by several people. One was my friend Amanda, who just sort of sent me an email or a screenshot being like, hey, I beat the game. And I was just like, what? That blew my mind, shook me up for a couple of minutes, actually. And then Nick sent me a great Stack Overflow link with a bunch of questions about what the optimal algorithm to beat 2048 would be. And that was a really good thread. So I recommend you guys read that if you're interested.
Mm-hmm. And that thread was sent to me by a friend after I snarkily commented, well, my friend and I don't think that 2048 is actually beatable.
Right.
And then I had to eat my words.
Well,
so,
you know,
thanks.
Well,
thanks.
His algorithm... Actually, the guy who posted the solution, the winning solution on Stack Overflow, it doesn't work 100% of the time. It only works, I guess, 80 to 90%. So it still fails every now and then. You know, it's not completely beatable, to our credit.
Yeah. There you go. We got something right.
At least 20% right.
There you go. Well, you know what? I'll take whatever I can get.
So. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's cool. That's cool, though. It's good to know. Have you beaten it yet?
I have not. I gave up. I got back to programming. It's one of those things that kind of took over for... It's basically like an internet Flappy Bird, you know?
Yeah.
You play it for a day or two, and it's like obsessive, and then you stop, and you move on. But it was a great game.
Yeah. Now, okay, so next thing you have... Going back to your gaming killer PC thing, whatever, you also said here that you wanted it to double as a Bitcoin mining machine.
Yeah, I tried to, so that may have been why I could not get the price to be under 750, but I wanted to actually get one of those like Bitcoin mining cards from Butterfly Labs.
Oh, so you're tacking $300 onto the price?
No, I wasn't.
Okay.
I was not, but if I did do that, like I wanted to see if I could recoup the cost of building a gaming PC by mining Bitcoins. And believe it or not, like with the calculations that I made based off of the current dollar amount of, you know, what Bitcoins translate to in dollars and how much I can actually mine, and given the fact that I won't be paying for internet because I have a place where I can just plug this bad boy in and not have to worry about that.
Well, and the internet connectivity is fairly low.
Yeah, but either way, the mid-range like card model would make me about $300 a month, and the high-end one, which costs about $2,500. Would make me about $600 a month. So it would, they would, you know, over the course of a few months, it would break even. But that's given things stay static, which probably will not be the case. There's a lot of
volatility in that market right now.
Yeah. So is it worth doing? I don't know. Is it interesting? Is it fun to think about? Totally.
Yeah.
Totally is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are, yeah, those are, it's always fun to run those. Those calculations, figure out what's your break even point.
Yeah, my place, like I don't have to pay utilities.
Yeah,
it's all included in my rent. So, if I draw tons more power, it's not going to raise my rent any much.
You're such a leech on society.
Well, I like to get my money's worth, Nick.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Interesting. Well, I've been working on some stuff recently. So I had a tragic piece of my childhood flittered away recently.
Uh oh, what happened?
My watch died. So
your G-Shock?
My G-Shock.
That epic G-Shock that you had since you were 10 G-Shock. Or 12?
Since I was 16. So this, the story goes, I have always had a thing for watches. I love watches. I think they're really, really awesome. And when I was younger, I would always have, you know, one of those, like, I'd save and buy one of those, like, cheap $10, you know, Walmart watches. And always digital, of course, because I didn't really know how to tell time. And, mm-hmm. And so I would always lose them. So right around the time my 16th birthday, Casio released, or at least I saw the G-Shock line. I read an article, I think in like Popular Science or something, and it had the G-Shock where they like dropped it off like a 10-story building,
mm-hmm.
and hit the concrete. They picked it up, put it back on their wrist, and I was like, oh my gosh, that's so cool. Especially when they set it up against this other watch that was designed to be high durability, and it was like this, like a traditional analog watch. It was like $120,000 or something. It like had all these, like, it had these precision milled springs that suspended the watch element and like held it within like three-dimensional space. It was actually really a clever piece of engineering, but
mm-hmm.
like, oh my gosh, or this far. They're like, or you just go buy this watch for $100. So I begged my parents for my birthday, and I was like, and of course I used, as a young teenager, you have impeccable logic, right? I said, well, what you realize is that the reason why I'm losing these watches is because they're cheap and I don't care about them. So if I got a nice watch, then it would, I would like have a reason to like take care of it and keep an eye on it and all of this stuff. And for some reason, probably because they were more compassionate than like, they didn't want to like beat my little child ego down. They were like, okay. So they got it for me for my birthday. And I had that thing every day until about a week and a half ago when I went up to Snoqualmie and went tubing out in the cold, and the watch kind of like died and never really came back.
Is it because the battery's dead? Or is
I
it
think cause... it's because the battery's dead. So I ordered a new set. I found some new batteries and ordered a new set. Those things are really, actually, those watches are like solid engineered, man. It took me forever to get that watch back off to like get the battery out and everything. It's like all strapped down and screwed. That's kind of amazing, actually. But So I'm hoping that the batteries come either today or tomorrow and I can replace it and get it, you know, working again. But so I was kind of looking at other watches to replace and all this stuff, and you know, I just realized, like, nobody really wears watches anymore, do they?
Mm-mm. No, I just carry my cell phone.
Everybody carries a cell phone. And I've been doing that for the last week. I hate it. How do you pull your cell phone out of your pocket all the time to check what time it is? I never know what time it is anymore.
I barely check the time. I don't know. I just don't even need to do it.
Wow. I think I'm just, like, old school or something, because, like, I'm always, like, looking at my watch to keep track of time and all this stuff. And like,
or it actually just beeps at me. It just, like, vibrates and it goes, you have a meeting in 10 minutes. Like, get ready to go.
Oh, so yeah. I guess. I don't know. Anyway, so I don't wear... It's funny because, like I said, nobody wears watches. And yet they seem to be in the news all the time right now. Have you seen the new Android Wear?
Mm-mm.
So the new Android SDK and kind of like OS or whatever for running on wearable devices.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the idea is that it's going to unify like the Google Glass line and like the other like Google Watches and things like that. And so Motorola announced, I think they called it the Moto 360, which actually is like gorgeous. I want to get one. I know it's going to be expensive, but it's like a high end, it's like a metal glass and leather, like actual like leather watch with a round watch face. As opposed to the so it looks like a traditional watch, but it is, it's round.
I think it's
it's digital,
sad,
I mean,
that we're moving away from computers. I feel like more and more we're going towards wearable technology.
Yeah,
and we're going to move away from cell phones even at some point. Sad.
Yeah. So it's, I don't know. It's very, yeah. It's, I mean, I like, yeah. The other thing is just the idea of just. Do I want to have no excuse for not checking my email or text messages? Like, if I have my Moto 360 on my wrist, like, all the time?
It looks really sleek.
It does look really sleek. I really kind of do want one, but, yeah, it's, I don't know. Apparently, I don't know. I don't know if I have a shirt that can rock that. I mean, this guy is pretty impeccably dressed. If you haven't been on their website... you should go check it out. This guy is definitely all the things that I wish that I could be in my life, I think. So, anyways, I don't know. So,
well, there was an Evernote type watch I saw recently.
Really?
I don't think it was built by Evernote, but I think it's a watch that the Pebble smartwatch, exactly.
Oh, there's Watch Note.
Right. So you can like just put apps onto that watch and you can activate them and use them. And I think it started out as a Kickstarter project, which cropped up a few years ago, and it's taken off really well. It's actually, most people I've talked to who have it are quite happy with it.
Cool.
And it's been expanded to take tons of new apps. So
yeah,
something else you could consider, because I'm sure you could have a watch app on that.
Oh, Apple Watch. You think that I could have a watch app on my watch? That would be so nice.
You know, watches could be used for... telling time as well as apps.
I mean, that seems kind of ridiculous, but I guess so. The Pebble Steel, how much is it?
I don't know.
It's like 200, I think, right?
I have no idea. I couldn't tell you. I would guess $100, but
150 for the color pebbles, and then the Pebble Steel is 230. So, but of course, it's back ordered. But anyways, that's kind of interesting. So it's interesting to see. You know, I guess they're trying to revitalize a accessory line that's kind of fading away.
It's kind of, to me, a watch seems more like it's a display of affluence. It's sort of like, I am so high and mighty, I'm going to wear a watch. Not just any watch, it's going to be a Rolex or it's going to be something fancy.
I think it definitely can be.
It's like male jewelry.
It is male jewelry. But, I mean, jewelry isn't inherently, like, a bad thing. I do like wearing the watches. I think that they're a really nice accessory. I think they, like, a nice watch can have, like, a nice little, like, kind of a subtle way to, like, draw focus or something like that. And
mm-hmm.
And I think it can complement, an outfit kind of nice. And this doesn't make it a bad thing.
Oh, certainly. Certainly can. But I don't know. It seems like...
I like watches I would try and wear my watch the way that I know, like, a lot of my female friends wear their jewelry, which is, like, subtle and understated, but classy. Or compliments, but doesn't draw.
It's sort of like expensive cufflinks. That's the way I look at it.
Yes, that's true as well.
You know, if you could spend $10 on your cufflinks, or you could spend $100 or, maybe even $1,000 if you're willing to spend that much money. But you can always tell people, hey, I spent $1,000 on my cufflinks. And the same way you can say, hey, I spent $500 on my watch.
Yeah.
You like it? Yeah, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Like, not to say I don't like it or I don't want one. I mean, they look really sleek and really cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess for me right now, with my priorities, I just don't think I would want one.
Yeah.
But it's cool.
So, speaking of Google and all their watches, have you looked at the Tango phone?
I have not. Please explain.
So the Tango phone is something that's finally coming out of their new lab group. What is it? The Advanced Technology and Projects Group. So when Google bought Motorola, one of the things they bought was kind of Motorola's like innovation development lab. And then when they sold Motorola to Lenovo for, like, oh my gosh, they lost so much money on that deal. it's a bad idea. They kept the ATP group, basically, Vince. Mm-hmm. And so they finally kind of demoed something. I think they did this at Mobile World or whatever. Called it the Tango smartphone platform. And basically what this is you've seen the augmented reality applications that come out for like the iPhone and stuff where uses the sensors to like basically pulls in Google feeds to tell you what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So they took this to the next level and created, it's called the Myriad One chip. And it is basically an ASIC that's designed to do 3D image, like 3D and like spatial imaging of rooms. So you can go in, or of basically anything, but it's designed to do like mapping and like hyperlocal mapping and stuff like that. So you can basically point it at something and it can take a look at the room and what you're looking at and like determine all these different characteristics and features about it. And it's a really kind of a cool, it processes visual and this audio data and builds like a really interesting and powerful sensor platform. And so they've developed it, and I think they're opening it up to developers to try and figure out what could you do if you had this type of information.
You know, I wonder why they do that. Because it seems like developers, they're a very small market.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Like, I wonder if they just kind of want to not hire programmers themselves, give people the opportunity to program things, make their own apps, make their own money, and then take a cut, just like Apple did. Is that the idea, just to have their own app store?
I think there's a portion of that. The other thing is that you're developing these new technologies and you have to figure out what to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
And what better way to do that than to like just hand out a couple hundred devices to people and have them start banging away on it and see what they figure out.
Sure.
I mean, it goes down to this idea of how do you predict there's a couple things that are playing here. One is, how do you predict the future? That's like a historically been a really hard problem. Mm-hmm. So rather than Google trying to predict the future, they're just saying, well, we'll just hand it off and we'll let other people try and figure that out and like come up with new ideas and stuff. And then the other thing goes back to, I mean, it goes back to resource allocation and stuff, where you say, how do you know what's best for people? Well, you don't, but people generally know best what's best for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So you put it into the hands of the developers and they solve the needs that they have, not the needs that you perceive them to have, right? We've talked before about the problem of startups designing for other startups and
mm-hmm.
Solving Silicon Valley's problems. And that's a very real issue. And so with Google, they can look at it and say, well, we'll just, you know, we'll send these devices to developers around the world and see what kind of cool problems they come up with and what they can try and solve.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking more about the whole startup solving problems for startups thing, and I think really that's just a lot of business-to-business companies kind of coming into the light earlier than they should, just so that way they can get hype around them and they can sell out for a higher price than they would be able to. You know, it's kind of this crazy, like, what's the right metaphor here? Like record companies, like bands selling mm-hmm. out to record companies.
Oh yeah.
Kind of, it's like, you know, the same sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, it's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting development. I think HTC is building a device that has a 3D camera in it, but basically that's just designed to do, it uses the processor, like the processor to like, do some augmenting, you know, like HDR and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this one, actually, they built a full chip to do all of this processing and integration and stuff. So now, basically, you can expose a set of APIs, and the device can, the applications can grab it and run it, and it doesn't just have to sit and chew up all the time on the CPU and stuff like that. So,
okay,
well, and so that could be turned into its own little chip. It'd be interesting because Google doesn't have a ton of experience or depth in chip manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
They used to have like the Google search boxes, which are like physical hardware, and they like manufacture and build like their own systems and servers and stuff, but that's just like kind of assembling a bunch of parts and building bigger systems. And now you're talking about, you know, etching things on silicon, which is a whole, you know, area that gets a little bit complicated. So they can fab it out, but it'll be interesting to see see if they can actually, like, what they do with this. Do they try and take it to market as a product? Do they license it to another company, which, or spin this off into its own little company that, with maybe the agreement that they won't develop for other mobile platforms?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but it's cool to see interesting things start to come to the forefront. And here's something that's really taking a kernel of an idea of what if I was able to see things, what if my phone could see the things around me like my eyes do and like my brain does, and turn that into a product and put it into the hands of people to start building interesting things.
Well, I think maybe if they kind of started to... Well, first off, is this Android-based?
Of course.
Okay. Well, maybe if they started to make...
I mean, the APIs are... The applications are written for the Android platform. Remember, it's a chip itself that does all of this. They built the Myriad One chip or whatever they call it. I think it's Myriad One. Yeah, Myriad One. It's a chip development. Or, I mean, it's an actual chip that processes all this computer vision.
Well, if you built the Swiss Army knife of cell phones... I guess, what would that contain?
That's a good question. One of the things that it would have, I mean, to have a really nice screen, I mean, to have a good high-quality screen, right? Mm-hmm. And probably about, like, 4.5 inches, I think, is kind of the ideal. 4.5 inches is, right now, I think, the really kind of ideal sweet spot. I like the multiple camera idea. I like especially having optimized for low light because that's where most images and things are taken care of. The ability to do some... I don't really care so much about 3D, but I care about being able to set multiple exposures to get better dynamic range or something like that.
What about straight up night vision?
Night vision. That's the other thing. Is like infrared would be kind of interesting.
Night vision, infrared, like heat.
Yeah.
To be able to hold up the phone to a wall and like detect heat.
Yeah.
That would be cool too.
I really like the M7 processor that's on the iPhones. I like and on the and on then the Motorola what is it the Motorola X, Moto X or something that has the voice chip. Having those specific chips to be able to all the time be accessing a set of sensor data or being able to immediately respond to commands without waking the whole SoC, I think is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so having those discrete, and now this Myriad One chip would be interesting as well. You know, basically all the sensors that I can get and ready to roll. And one thing that I'm excited that's starting to come is, you know, I don't know if link aggregation is the correct term, but basically the device will switch between sending data over Wi-Fi or cellular based on like the quality of the connection.
Mm-hmm.
And link aggregation, I think, is different because that's actually defined in the LTE spec as aggregating multiple bands together to achieve, but I don't remember. But anyways, like something like that would be kind of cool.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's kind of hard. I mean, again, this becomes a difficulty. Like, what are cell phones not doing now that you wish that they did?
Well, you know, I think that's the thing. I think all this time people are working on making technology better without actually understanding why or what for. Like, there's no real application. New application that they need to make technology better for. They're just making it better, which I think they have to do to, you know, keep the shareholders happy and to sort of, you know, show them that they're growing and improving. But at the same time, it could be just a waste of resources for where they could be using that time and money to work on something that's a real problem.
Yeah.
Even if it's a small problem, it's something that would actually help the world.
So I think you've illustrated a really good tension that needs to happen. So I've been reading a book recently called The Idea Factory, which is about Bell Telephone Laboratories, which is like this...
A tragedy, if you ask me.
A tragedy, right? They're all... like Park.
Xerox, yeah.
Yeah.
It's also a tragedy.
Tragedy, right? So this one's really interesting because it had a really long run from like the 30s to like, wow. I mean, when did Plan 9 get developed? Because that came out of Bell Labs. So that... I don't remember. It came out in late 1990s, basically. And that is really, I mean, that's really cool. So they had this really long run. And one of the things I was reading about was they developed the transistor and they really didn't have a whole lot of applications for it. And eventually they turned it and they built something called ESS, the electronic switching system.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they replaced like all their old mechanical relay, one of their big mechanical relay switching stations in New Jersey or something with a new transistor one. And yes, it used lower power. It might be more reliable. They thought it, at least they thought it was, but it wasn't necessarily more reliable. And then it switched stuff a lot faster. But to the user, that was largely, like, nobody would notice.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, what does the thing has? Well, it has a lot of extra bandwidth. Well, what are we going to use this extra bandwidth for? Well, I don't know, but it exists. Well, they put it in, and 15 years later, you start playing with cell phones. And they had upgraded their whole network to run on these ESS systems, and then all of a sudden they were able to handle the added bandwidth of the mobile phones that hadn't been really thought of or invented at that point.
Well, sure, but if you thought about how we could maybe reinvent that technology today, do you think we could do a better job? Are we being limited by yesteryear's kind of...
I mean, I think the answer is yes and no. It depends on what you're talking about. I think there are areas in which we operate under the same very fundamental mindset of this is how such things are done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy, I think, to improve and iterate and refine things. But it's very difficult to figure out how things are going to be. So I was in a talk a couple months ago in the Washington chapter of the Health Information Management System Society.
Mm-hmm.
And the speaker was talking, and he said, one of the things that we noticed is that all the EHR systems, the electronic health systems, are built for the way that we do medicine and deliver healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of stopped. Everyone was like, yeah, obviously, he said. But they're not built for the way that we will do healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And so you think about that, and you think about, and you say, well, at this point, we don't even know what that'll look like because, regulatory burden and just all, and the changing landscape, like all of this stuff. But if you were to ask somebody to design an EHR system, and if you gave it to even a really innovative, brilliant company and asked them to do it, what would they do? Well, they would build something that solved today's need. If you ask them to design something that would be useful not tomorrow but in 10 years, would they be able to do it?
Well, I don't know. Not well, at least.
Probably not.
And I think
they might be able to. They might really hit upon a way that says, we've built the system, now we have to drive the industry into it because eventually the industry is going to realize that this is where we're going.
Right, and I see what that speaker is saying, but I think we have to go through – I mean, to get to tomorrow, we have to go through the stepping stone of today.
I think we oftentimes do. I don't know if it necessarily. I think there are times. There's a couple of ways in which that changes are slow evolution over time, and then you get to something that you can say, okay, now functionally this is new. Mm-hmm. And then you also get times of like punctuated equilibrium, where somebody drops a bombshell, and mm-hmm. you're just like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, and we have the quote unquote disruption, industry disruption. Yeah.
But I think if you grabbed a random startup and asked them to build an EHR system, what would it look like?
Exactly like something else out in the market today.
It would look like Facebook.
You think?
It would look similar. It would look like something along those lines. It'd be a responsive web design, of course, right? So
mm-hmm.
it'd be a web app. It would be responsive. And
maybe using Node.
I mean, something like that. I mean, it's easy to pick the technological like components out. Be like, oh, it would do this, it would do this, right?
Neo4j in the back end.
Yeah. I don't know. But then what would it look like and what would it function like? I think it would look pretty similar to something like Facebook.
It could be. But I'm not really sure
or you look like something like Confluence. It looked like a basic collaboration software right now. Why? Because the model that's emerging right now that we're on the edge of is team-based medicine.
Mm-hmm.
But what are you orienting the unit of care around? What are you orienting the encounter around? And I don't know. We haven't, and that's where we're kind of moving into. But that's like an evolutionary step from not just a doctor and maybe a nurse to now team-based medicine. But that's still reflective of that's still built in a really changing environment that. What is tomorrow going to look like? What are going to be the defining metrics and the success factors?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's really hard to predict. I think it's really hard to predict the future. And we need people to be working on slow, iterative changes that are going to improve and solve the immediate problems right here, right now. And that's what they say drove Bell Labs, is that there was never a shortage of problems because the Bell system was so big, so complicated, and they had to deal with things like anything we put in the field has to be Has to run for 40 years because we just can't replace it all. Like, has to be, there are all these constraints that created, in a sense, this sort of necessity to innovate.
You know, I'm thinking about why medicine might have the problems it has today, and although people might hate to admit it, I think this, it's because, like, their biggest setback is the same thing that protects them, like their biggest strength, and that medicine has this sort of guild mentality.
Yeah.
Because of that, they can't innovate because everybody, you know, in that guild has to be on board, at least the majority of people.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, in tech, that doesn't exist. You don't have to have some kind of a tech license or a computer science license to be a programmer. You can just, if you have a degree, if you got the chops, you got the chops. And that's that. Whereas if you're a lawyer or a doctor, I mean.
Or an engineer.
Engineers, too. They actually have a guild.
Oh, yeah. Professional engineers. PE.
Oh, that. But isn't that just like a PMP? Isn't that like one of the certifications you can get?
No. Well, so you have to get from an accredited engineering program. You have to pass your fundamentals of engineering exam, which is just like basic, which you can't take that unless you graduate from an accredited program. But it's like, I mean, it's like basic competency is like a misnomer because it's like really hard and complicated. But basically, it certifies that you have the minimum level of knowledge. Then you have to do 5 years of working under a licensed PE.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can sit for the PE exam and then become a professional engineer.
Wow, I did not know that. That's interesting.
And my friend, I was at the conference the other week in Orlando, and my roommate was a certified clinical engineer. He's from Canada, and he has like he wears his guild ring, and he carries with him the oath of the engineer, which is like created by Rudyard Kipling. It's like really kind of awesome, like. It's really...
Rudyard Kipling?
Yeah, Rudyard... I think it's Kipling, right?
Well, he was an author.
He was
the author of Rikki Tikki Tavi, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I think he wrote The Jungle Book, right? And... So anyways, he was hired to do...
He was an engineer?
No, they hired him... I can't spell oath, but they hired him to write The Ritual of the Calling of the Engineer, the request of the Canadian Professional Engineers. And it's really kind of awesome.
That's so interesting. That's, history is so crazy.
Yeah, and so I read it, and it's just like really, yeah, it's just really cool.
Speaking of which, I read somewhere that, I think it was on Reddit, that Oxford was actually founded in like the year 1250 something, which is so far back. Like, God, who knew? Harvard was founded in like 1600, you know, 45 or something like that, but. I mean, Oxford's been around for a long time.
It's been around for a really, really time. A really long time. So I can't find... I wish I could find the text of it. I'll see if I... It was really, really beautiful. But anyways, yeah, so these things have been around for a really long time. And they take this stuff very, very seriously. And tradition matters. And everything that you do has to be weighed against... not only your obligations to this community, but your obligations to, like, society and all these kinds of things. And yes, I think it does slow some things down, but I think it also recognizes that things that we do matter, and they have gravity and weight to them.
Right.
And too often we consider this idea of disruption implies that things that are now are simply disposable. They're simply the way that they are, not because they should be this way, but because we just haven't come up with anything better.
Mm.
Which may be true, but isn't ontologically true. That may be the case right now, that my computer is, you know, I've got 23 minutes of battery life left. Not because a computer should only have 4 hours of battery life, but because that's the limits of the technology. But there are other things in this world that exist this way because they should be that way. The idea that you learn your traits from a master in the field is something that is to be admired and admonished, and I think that there should be more of that. In the UK, or not in the UK, in Europe, they do more of the tradesmen, where you have to like apprentice under somebody, to recognizing that there are skills and traditions and ways of doing things that are passed down through generation. That doesn't mean that we don't use science to like inform and modify those things. So you look at like an electrician is a guild. And electricians are guild members. That doesn't mean that they don't embrace like digital signaling or smaller multimeters or a better understanding of electronics, so that way they can say like the way that you separate, high voltage lines from digital signal lines. Right now we understand electricity a lot more. We realize that you'll just swamp that. Well, so it's not that these things are run together because they are run together,
mm-hmm.
but that there are certain ways in which the way that you do your job that is it necessarily captured purely in memorization?
I think with the way you just explained it, almost anything could be considered a guild, right? Like even academia, you have your advisor.
Academia is definitely, that is absolutely a guild. That's one of the three original. They talk about the three or four original guilds was academia, was law. The three were law, medicine, and priesthood.
And who?
Priesthood.
Priesthood, right.
So priests, lawyers, and physicians. Mm-hmm. And those were the three that you ran. And academia came out of that. Why? Because it taught those three things.
Mm-hmm.
Or law or philosophy. But those were like the, those were like the, yeah. Wow. Anyways. So, and academia comes out of that guild mentality. It absolutely is. And I think that there's a lot that has merit to it. It's not perfect. It's not infallible like any system. No system is. But I think that there's a lot that should be recovered in how we approach and how we do things.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, we are right at an hour.
Oh, perfect. Which means this is the best time to to call it quits.
Absolutely. Now, we do have a little bit of an apology to make. We said that we were going to send out a survey to kind of pull our listeners and see what we could do better and what we should improve on and what we should never do again. And, well, it's finals week, so we didn't get that done.
Yeah, but it's gonna happen.
It'll come, yeah. So, like I said, guys, no podcast next week, so you can take time to go back and listen to your favorite Informatonauts episode again. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with who knows what we'll have, but it'll definitely be good, and we'll enjoy it. So.
Yep. So be sure to follow us on Twitter at Informatonauts. You can follow me or Nick individually as well. I'm at Nikhil Gopal. That's NikhilGopal. And you can follow Nick at Nick Robison.
NikRobison.
Right. So thank you guys for tuning in, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Take care, guys.